a crisis and that there's a surge, when in fact the only crisis is the way that Border Patrol dehumanizes migrants who are only trying to seek protection in the United States.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation in Spanish after the broadcast, and we'll post it on our Spanish website. You can go to democracynow.org and click through. Erika Pinheiro, immigration attorney, executive director of Al Otro Lado. Gerlin Joseph, with the Haitian Bridge Alliance, heads that organization. And Erika Guevara Rosas, America's director for Amnesty International, speaking to us from Mexico City. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rose, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Taracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are currently accepting applications for the position of membership coordinator. The membership coordinator is responsible for planning and developing KBOO's fundraisers and on-air membership drives, data entry, working with major donors, direct mail campaigns, and community outreach. This position is 25 hours per week. For the full job description and instructions for applying, go to our website at kboo.fm/membership-hire or send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight, Friday, May 19th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information for the May special election at lwvpdx.org. The website has explanations of ballot measures on services for renters and for children and public safety. The League informs voters because every vote matters.
Peace, y'all. This is Big Guru, Gifted Unlimited Rhymes Universal, in the house right now on Hard Knock Radio, okay, baby?
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
I am Elizabeth Pichita Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio.
Oh,
and you are?
I'm Yuri Kochialma with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. When I'm not throwing down on the floor of Congress, looking out and fighting for your rights, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We want to bring attention to a disturbing situation that has made national news in New York City. It brings back, for people who are old enough, the situation involving a gentleman by the name of Bernard Goetz, who decided that crime was way too much on the New York City subways and infamously shot four people in the back and killed them, and, you know, and it was a big... It set off a big conversation about vigilante justice and, you know, crime and what people should be doing if they're fed up and the whole nine. Well, sadly, we saw that kind of get revisited last week with the choking death, choke on camera, as people stood around and watched, of somebody who was transient, somebody who had a mental breakdown, somebody who was known because they did impersonations of Michael Jackson as an entertainer, trying to find some sort of money in a city that never sleeps and doesn't take care of its poor. His name was Jordan Neely, and there's been a lot of protest in New York City, and we wanted to talk to some of the folks who have their finger on the pulse and can let us know exactly what's happening. Joining us is Derek, and Derek, let everybody know the organization that you're a part of.
I am a part of Warriors in the Garden. My name is Derek Ingram. I'm a co-founder of Warriors in the Garden. We're a collective of activists here in New York City. We came together on the front lines during the initial protest on May 29th of 2020 in response to the unjustified killing and murder of George Floyd.
So what is happening now? And are you surprised that we're kind of back in a similar space? I mean, people were enraged to watch George Floyd be killed with a knee on his neck with a smirking cop for 8 minutes and 40 seconds is how long it took. Here we saw somebody, a former Marine, put somebody in a chokehold on a subway. And as people said, hey, you're going to kill him, kept that chokehold going as people filmed and didn't intervene, and then tried to justify it when this person was killed. Tell us what we know about that. What is missing from the national narrative?
That's part of the outrage. And we talk about the duality of what happened to Jordan, because he does meet at an intersection of so many margins and issues that run rampant within New York City. I mean, that's why a collective of so many different activist groups and organizations and people have been on the streets in New York. Jordan was houseless. He failed to have access to so many different resources. He was hungry, lacking nourishment. He was thirsty, but also he was suffering from mental illness. And of course, he was a Black man. So there's so many different groups that come out to address all those different issues, and we've come together collectively to voice our concern and demand justice for Jordan Neely, but at the same time address the systemic issues that led up to Jordan Neely being killed, publicly lynched on a New York City subway. So we want to definitely have justice for Jordan, but also in that justice, we want to make sure that there's not another Jordan, because there's going to be thousands more if we don't address the systemic issues and the institutional oppression that has been happening across New York City, but also nationally, in terms of giving people access to resources, access to help, and addressing the increase in loneliness and suicides and mental health issues that has really skyrocketed since COVID.
We're going to be addressing with our next interview folks that are locally here in the Bay Area with the killing of Benko Brown, a transient youth, transgender in this case, who was shot and killed in almost with the same conditions that you just described, Jordan. You know, 3,000 miles away, and we're talking about, you know, similar situations. In the case of Jordan, one of the things that stood out for many of us is that here the person who witnessed his parents, his mom, being choked to death by her boyfriend. He had to deal with that and really never got the help needed, never got over that death, never was nurtured, never was taken in, never was, you know, made whole, if you can ever be made whole by such a tragedy, but somehow managed to bring smiles to people's faces as an entertainer, even if they were having these mental breakdowns, which, you know, have resulted in the newspapers referring to him as somebody who had a lengthy criminal record. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because when you hear criminal record, we're thinking somebody who is doing the most dastardly of things, you know, like sticking you up, raping you, doing these extreme acts of violence. And from what I hear, that wasn't him when we talk about having that criminal record. Maybe I'm wrong, but maybe you can fill in the gaps for us.
The mass majority of his arrests were nonviolent. And one thing we've known through our research and also in talking to houseless and unsheltered community members is a lot of the times they feel more comfortable inside the institutions because they know where their next meal is coming from. They know where they're going to sleep that night. They're going to have, you know, heat during the winter. And that may have been the case for Jordan. I also know that Jordan was formally diagnosed with autism, schizophrenia, and in talking to some of his friends that we are in community with, he suffered from depression and possibly PTSD from what he witnessed, and you brought it up, which was the killing of his mother as well. I really really am proud of my community for coming together for this, but we're really having a call to action for the citizens of New York City. There have not been enough people out. I think there has to be a discussion about people really seeing houseless people and people that don't have access and privilege as invisible. And I think that's why Jordan was in a chokehold. I think that's why Jordan was lynched, is because he wasn't valued. And he wasn't valued by the person that did it, but he also wasn't valued by the individuals that watched for 15 minutes him lose his life.
I want to ask you about that. In the case of George Floyd, which spawned your organization, people felt helpless as they watched because there were four armed officers with guns who were ready to shoot if you intervened. And nobody really wanted to lose their life that day. Fortunately, those officers are all doing time for that horrific act. But this thing was a little different because we're not talking about a police officer. We're talking about a former Marine who took it upon themselves to put somebody in a chokehold. Now, let's just say, for argument's sake, you wanted to protect people because whoever was being choked in this case, let's just say we believe the narrative and Jordan was having an episode and was going off. There were lots of people there. So why was this allowed to happen? Why was a death allowed to occur when people were there, when they could have easily said, okay, enough's enough, let's restrain them, let's get help if it's in the form of police or whatever, but why let this death go?
I really think there has to be a conversation about how post-Trump era, there has been so much propaganda that has always existed within the United States, but has become more and more brazen concerning the vilification, demonization, and criminalization of Black bodies. People now believe that they can take justice into their own hands, especially when it's a Black individual and a Black individual that doesn't have access. And I'm positive that's what this situation is an example of. Somebody that they saw as voiceless, somebody they saw as poor, somebody they saw as Black with no resources, they took advantage of that. And it's this idea that someone of a different class or a different race is superior or inferior. And I think that's exactly what happened to Jordan. A vigilante saw someone and they took justice into their own hands. And I just really think if the shoe was on the other foot, if the person would have been a different race or a different class, that it wouldn't have turned out this way. So that's why when we have these conversations and we talk about legislative, political change and societal change, we have to talk about how we treat our people on the margins and what resources we have for them. And we have to think about how we interact with houseless people on the daily. Turning on your cell phone or just turning away when you see something isn't okay. Jordan's life was taken by somebody using their bare hands and no one intervened, let alone intervened. Some people were complicit and helped. And if you ask me, the people that just watched were complicit as well.
There has been a narrative, which you alluded to, Derek, that suggests the economic challenges that are facing us is really because of these people that are sleeping in our doorways and just haven't really pulled themselves up by the bootstrap. This homeless population, which is very visible here in San Francisco and Oakland, which is very visible in New York, even in the middle of winter. I was just there in the winter and folks are there. But it's visible all around the United States. But with that being said, if we can just get rid of that permanent underclass, then our problems would disappear. I'm asking this, and I'm putting forth this narrative that I see festering, because from your perspective in New York City, which has been hit pretty hard with criticism around? What are you going to do about all these people sleeping on the subways, et cetera, et cetera? If there's a pressure from the mayor, Eric Adams, a pressure from the DA, who on one hand is demonized because he's going after Donald Trump, but on the other hand, it's like, hey, you know, maybe you need to be a little bit tougher on crime, and tough on crime may show up in not pressing charges on a vigilante. In other words, there's a political or potential political audience that can be pandered to at this moment. And do you see that? Do you see that playing out either in Jordan's situation or just as a general trend?
Absolutely. So the election of Eric Adams was a spit in the face to every single activist here in New York City. The reason he won was because of political theater, and also because he was a former cop. And that was the first time New York City has ever participated in ranked choice voting, which is a completely different conversation. But he ran on a campaign of fear that New York City was crumbling, New York City was full of vagrants and criminals, and he was going to clean the streets. He stoked that fear not only with some of our white residents here in New York City, but he was convincing Black residents and our Black elderly people that he was going to help clean up our streets as well. And to me, just removing houseless people or removing people that you see as an underclass or criminal doesn't really address the root cause of a lot of these societal issues. Because since Eric Adams has come into office, houselessness has skyrocketed.
I was about to say, this is the same scenario in San Francisco. They got a new district attorney that was supposed to clean up crime. Crime ain't been cleaned up. They were supposed to have a cop come into office in New York City. Things actually gotten worse. So I'm wondering how we make sense of that, because it seems like, and I didn't mean to cut you off, so please continue your thoughts, Derek, but it seems like people are holding on to a fantasy even when the reality shows something different.
Absolutely. And I think it's easy. I think it's too easy to blame those with less opportunities, less access, and less resources on the state of the local economy, on the criminal issues that may be happening within a city, without addressing, at the same time that we're truly criminalizing poverty in this city, we've cut resources. So you're blaming houseless people for being houseless without giving them resources. He's cutting funding to schools, after school programs, different art programs, mental health resources. Those are the things that keep people alive. He just got rid of additional SNAP benefits that were increased due to COVID. He's cut those back again as we have rising food costs. We have stores in New York City that are being raided, but guess the things people are stealing? Pampers, food, medicine. That is going on in what is supposed to be the economic hub of America. We have people stealing food because they don't know when they're going to eat. And that's completely unacceptable. And I really feel like we have someone in office that is a Black body, but being ran by white policies and white ideals that are highly problematic and rooted in anti-Blackness. And we know how that coincides with the demonization of those who are less fortunate.
Derek, we don't have a lot of time, but I want you to take some time to let our audience what you would like to see them do. But one of the things that stands out is that from talking with people like yourselves and others, you have not fallen into the trap of allowing the life of Jordan Neely to be a singular runoff, one-off. The national narrative is like, this guy was a problem and it's heroic, quotations around the word heroic, ex-Marine, you know, did something good. He protected the folks on the subway. And you're bringing the case that this is systemic and it goes above and beyond. Can you break that down for us? Am I right in my understanding of that? Because it's easy to write Jordan off. It's a lot harder to write off the scenario that you've been talking about.
Jordan is just the catalyst. He's an amazing catalyst, again, because of the way his life intersected. But Jordan was also failed by the system. He was failed by government. He was failed by community. He was failed by the individuals on that subway. He was failed by the NYPD. Jordan needs justice. And to me, justice doesn't look like just the case for Jordan. It looks like addressing these systemic issues that led to his death. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Jordans throughout America. And we want to see change. And the only way that change is going to happen is if we bring attention to the issues that led up to his death. And if we see not only a change societally and how we think, but also legislatively. So what we're focusing on now, because the budget is coming up in New York City, is calling all of our city council members to account, calling our mayor and governor to account. And then also we're calling on community to amplify the message that we're sending. And so what we plan on doing as Warriors in the Garden for May Day, for the month of May, we've come together with other organizations. We're calling ourselves the May Days, and we're planning 15 actions that will financially impact New York City and help those that are houseless and unhoused and hungry. And if anybody can spread the word via social media, if anybody can call or email a city council member here in New York City, that's definitely would be amazing support and just an amazing start, because this is going to be a long fight. This is going to be a battle. And one thing I've learned in fighting New York City that has the largest police department in North America is that this city does not react. The police department doesn't react to just a march. It doesn't react to just being vilified. We have to impact them where it hurts, which is their pockets. And that's what we plan on doing.
How do people get a hold of Warriors in the Garden?
They can follow us on Instagram at Warriors in the Garden. They can follow us on Twitter at Warriors ITG. Also, they can just honestly, any way, any social media, you can definitely find Warriors in the Garden. Again, I'm D-Rec Ingram. I'm a co-founder. I have dealt with the police. I've been surrounded, tracked, and surveilled by the police for the last 4 years. The police surrounded my apartment unlawfully with a battering ram, dogs, canines, weapons. It's a very long story, but everyone in my group is used to dealing with police brutality and the police violence that we experience here in New York City, being Black and Brown folks. And we're here to just make sure that the world knows exactly what's going on and how savage that the New York City Police Department is, and how our community has failed yet another resident.
D-Rec, we appreciate you taking time out. I won't ask you about the stopping of the subway because you're on the air, but we'll let people read between the lines around protest and figure that out.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Thank you so much.
Survival is the name of the game downtown. It's not the place to be if you don't know your way around, cause they don't play around in this part of town. Last night this kid was found in an alley with a bullet in the back of his head. Over what? A bottle of crack and he's dead. And everyone claimed that they didn't see nothing, but yo, somebody had to see something. But don't ask the man with the brown paper bag in his hand eating food off the garbage can, cause he'll start telling you gory old war stories about how he served his country. Served his sergeant, got the purple heart. Now he's living on the street, trying not to starve. But he don't want a job, he just wants to be left alone in his home street, home downtown. I was taking
riding the bus one day last week, and I missed my stop cause I fell asleep. But when I woke up and took a look around, I found that I had wound up uptown. Hopped off the bus and stepped on the pavement. All I could do was stare in amazement. I mean, the grass was green, the streets were clean. I'd read about it, but I've never seen it with my own eyes. And everything's true and everything's brand spanking new, man. If I had a chance to live this good, you know I would. But in my neighborhood, there's not enough unity to clean up the community. But collectively, if we took responsibility, it would be a better place to be downtown. On my block, call me a mooly. The pushers and pimps all walk with limps, and the kids are trying to break their necks to get a glimpse of the fat gold chains or the funky fresh cars. Neighborhood drug czars are treated like stars. Peter's got a beeper and he thinks he's cool. So cool that he even bought a gun to school. Yo, why'd you bring a tool? Who you gonna shoot? Buddy says that his neighborhood is like Beirut, and something's always going down. Or when you're living downtown.
JVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to talk about something that has been bubbling in the community. There's been an attempt to kind of redirect attention around it and downplay what has been troubling many people in the community. It is the shooting death of Banco Brown. Many people may have heard this. Banco was in a Walgreens, I believe it was, or some store that was on Market. The narrative that we've been presented says Banco tried to steal something, threatened a security guard, and the security guard had no choice but to shoot Banco, and that's where we're at. People in the community kind of did their research and came up with a whole other story. And we want to find out what's happening because a lot of folks have been protesting. A lot of folks are very upset. At the very least, should someone be shot by a security guard if they are unarmed because they stole something? Joining us from an organization formerly known as the Women's Center is Julia Arroyo. Welcome to the show, and thank you for talking to us. What's the new name of the organization?
So the new name of the organization is the Young Women's Freedom Center.
The Young Women's Freedom Center. No stranger to our airwaves. Let's... Yeah. Fill in the blanks in what's been happening. Why have people been upset in the community, and why is the narrative of those who are upset very, very different than what we've been presented with from the district attorney and, you know, and corporate media outlets?
Well, I know the call to action for right now is the release of the tapes. So that is something that, you know, we're all asking for them to release the tape. So then they're could be this, let the community see these tapes. But the national, I even feel like the national conversation is demanding the ending of terrorizing and killing of Black youth and Black people, you know, and when we get into it even further, you know, of Black transgender people. So the thing that really touched my heart was with, you know, Banco really trying to find safe housing for himself. And while there was different housing options throughout the years, he never quite felt safe. I was just scrolling through all of my text messages where he would say at nighttime, you know, I'm not safe here. I need a safe passage to somewhere safer for myself. And so he was also on wait list for housing. He was part of so many different nonprofit programs. He was an activist. And, you know, he was always trying to support other people. You know, he was always had small children around him. He was always supporting women in the community. And, you know, it's just unfortunate because we were robbed of a potential next leader in San Francisco. That's on the trajectory that he was inside of his life. And regardless of whatever the narrative is being painted about this, something being taken from this store, which I can't comment on because I don't know the for sure facts. I know there's videos and things, but I've worked with this young person for so many years, I can't bring myself to watch the videos that have been released. So I can't say exactly what happened that day, but I know that for sure that there was no weapon and that his life was taken from him. And there's nothing in that store that is worth a human's life. Speaking with a lot of young people right now, they're talking about their experiences of just walking into a store in San Francisco as a Black body person, or, you know, just their experience of what they go through every day. And so I don't know exactly for what that experience is like, but I know what young folks tell me. And I also know what it's like just even myself walking through a store in San Francisco. It's not not apparent, you know, what's currently happening, but we demand a serious plan to intervene in the killing of Black youth by law enforcement and private security in San Francisco. We're also demanding through a thorough investigation into the use of deadly force by the security guard, and we want to automatically disarm, you know, security guards inside of San Francisco. Why do they have firearms to protect profit? You know, they're supposed to observe and report, and that's not what occurred this day. And so for the other piece of it is we're calling an urgent need for housing for trans youth. The San Francisco Chronicle just called me and said that they have, you can't quote on this one, but they said the Trans Navigation Center in San Francisco has 1,000 people on the wait list. There's some TASE housing with at least 96 people on the wait list. And then the rental subsidy specifically for trans young people is 143 on the wait list. So there's, you know, the numbers are just, you know, hearing those numbers were heartbreaking to me. You know, Banco was doing it, struggled every day. He sent me text messages every day to tell me that he on his search and journey for housing, you know, and they told him to call every Monday and then to call throughout the week. They told him to line up at shelter beds. He was turned away from shelters, and he was exhausted. He was tired.
So, Julia, there's a number of issues here. Maybe we could go through a few of them.
Okay.
Issue one is San Francisco, like Chicago, has become national fodder for particular agendas that want to be pushed. Chicago, because of the headlines that have made the news, is a place where you hear people go, we need to send in the National Guard, and it's so much crime and it's out of control, and it's the epitome of a city that is going down the hill. And so if there's a National Guard, or if there's a clapback on any Black youth in particular in Chicago, the seed has been planted that people almost justify it. Well, these kids are out of control. The statistics do not add up to the reality, meaning that, you know, what we see on TV is an exaggeration for something that, you know, city has problems, but it ain't to the degree that it's being reported. On the other hand, San Francisco has made national headlines. We've all seen the video of people walking into stores, filling up bags, and walking out. That scene was the reason that we saw Chesa Boudin, you know, become ousted. And with that came a set of politics and policies that suggested that San Francisco was going to get tough on crime, and this tough on crime posture was a way to signal to the rest of the world that they were going to push back on quote unquote lawlessness, which they attribute to people who are either on drugs or homeless. So I bring all this up because the narrative that I'm literally seeing and hearing is that if this person walked into a store and stole something, well, by gosh, they deserve to get what they got, because it's ruining the economy and it's causing this city by the bay, you know, this gem of a city, to have a bad reputation. And so that's an issue on image. And I want to know how you see that playing out as somebody who has an organization that is based there. How do you deal with that? Because it seems like putting forth an image of San Francisco that is, one, attractive to tourists, and two, will have zero tolerance for any sort of transgressions, seems to overshadow the reality that you just painted of people who feel unsafe, people who can't afford $3,000 and $4,000 rents, et cetera, et cetera. And people that are well-meaning that you would never think are kind of like, well, if they're stealing, God dog it, they need to stop. And if they can't stop, then c'est la vie. How do we deal with that narrative? It's a real one.
Yeah. So I think that what there's like this kind of fear-mongering kind of conversations that are kind of fluttering our airwaves and the internet and things like that, which was really a loss of businesses inside of San Francisco, with the even folks pulling out of businesses. We can see that businesses are, they even previous to what you're kind of talking about, businesses have been pulling out, and this city was built on like tourism and things like that. So and has never really prioritized its people, even with some of the redlining that has happened historically in San Francisco for Black folks, and even the loss of even inside of neighborhoods like the Fillmore and the Mission District and things like that. So it's never really placed a lot of value on the people here. But this is also a place where folks have called home for many generations. And it's just really unfortunate. You know, I've been working with and have also experienced being in the incarceral system as a young person and a foster youth as well. And this is, and, you know, over half of the folks that are inside of that facility are arrested for meeting their convictions of things that are of meeting their basic immediate needs, stealing food, clothing, things like that. And so, you know, I don't have all of the answers, but I know how when these laws are created, you know, that it disproportionately impacts Black people first. Right. You know, so that's something that's way unfortunate, that those are the folks that are over-policed and killed.
As you were talking, Julia, from the Young Women's Freedom Center in San Francisco, I was thinking, like, wow, last week, Banco was killed, and then we saw the headlines that went around nationally that Neiman Marcus was pulling out of the Westfield Mall, and that comes on the heels of a Trader Joe's shutting down and a few other businesses. So you mentioned something that's real important, that the city's built on tourism, but it's also built on the fact that people need to come to a downtown, that they don't want to come to a downtown anymore. Meaning that we have folks that during the pandemic moved, said, hey, I can do my work from home, and I don't need to come into a city where I have to endure traffic. For people who don't know, by commuting in the morning, you know, I work in the city, and it's literally an hour and a half to get from here to SF State in the morning. And it's definitely an hour and a half to come back. You know, and that's just me, where I live near the freeway entrances. But for people who have to live further away, it's 2 and 3 hours. And so I bring this up because after the pandemic, people realized, said, well, why do I need to come into the city? And many people stayed home. And so now there's been this undercurrent of we need you back, but we don't need you back because we really want to see Dave or Julia's faces. We need you back because these stores that pay premium amount of money to have space in downtown no longer have the traffic because we don't feel like driving into the city. I bring this up because
they took away the ability to park places. Yes. And they took away to drive. You can't even drive on Market Street anymore. So.
Right. So it's a real pain. So it's $30, $40 to park, et cetera, et cetera. It might be good for a visit. You know, we can do it on a weekend, but I can't do it every day. But I bring this up because, as you were alluding to, many of these people were starting to move in that direction anyway. Stores were closing prior to the pandemic because competition is online. I'd rather order my gifts from Amazon than come into the city. So stores were shutting their doors all around the country. But it seemed like when stores shut in San Francisco, the tagline changed, the narrative changed, and it was like, oh, it's because of quality of life. That's it. And I'm wondering if we can address that, because again, I don't know why they would say that when they already had plans to close, but it seems like a backwards way to demonize the city and particular populations within the city.
Yes, absolutely. Even one of the things, just personally, when loved ones come to visit me in San Francisco and say, can you recommend a place for me to eat at? And I go, I don't even know my own city. I don't even know my own city anymore. As I got to double check if places are still open or what they are. And I live here every day. So, I mean, like, even for our elder folks too, I have an elder in my family that said, I don't even like to drive around the city anymore because it interferes with her dementia, because she says, I can't tell if something's reality or not because it's not the city I remember. It's just that the places and the landmarks that historically she could remember and recall to are just not there anymore. So it's hard to see, a San Francisco this way. And, especially for small businesses. But now the corporations are feeling the impact of it, so, and pulling out themselves.
So there's a newer population that has moved in, and that population is like, San Francisco is too liberal. People like you and others are excusing incomprehensible behavior. How do you respond to that population when that becomes a politic that is being pushed? Is it rooted in something that is understandable, or is it rooted in anti-blackness, anti-queerness, anti-liberalism? I don't know.
You said it right there. I mean, it's truly, truly, it is to me all of those things. I could speak for what it's like for, young people make up only 11% of the population in San Francisco, right? Compared to other major cities, that could be 40 to 60% of their populations being youth. So young people fight to be seen here, to have spaces. There's a running kind of joke that happens in the city of that we got more dog parks than we got more, kids parks here. So you can just see what folks have to experience that live here. And for somebody that my family has been here for, several generations and had hands in building San Francisco. And I can hear so many of stories of we have this project that's going on at our site right here. It's called Bridging the Gap. And basically it's a multi-generational space of Black folks that historically have lived here and grew up here. And they storytell about the things that the San Francisco they remember. And so it's truly heartbreaking when, you've had a piece in building something and yet they only want you for your labor or your service, and they don't actually want you. They want you for your culture or your what you bring to enhance what it is, but they don't want you. that's a hard thing. That's a very hard thing to that's a really hard thing to try and grapple with myself.
Let's come back, Julia, to the policies. Brooke Jenkins, the district attorney, promised that crime would go down in San Francisco on her watch.
Yeah.
Nothing's really changed, you know, from what we can see. You know, San Francisco made headline news when the tech executive was killed, and you had folks walk around and they blamed people like Banco and folks that you may work with. Oh, these are the folks. And then we find out it was another tech executive, and then everybody wanted to walk that back. But with that being said, the pressure is on a district attorney who said, I'm going to clean things up. And so I bring this up because once upon a time, if you shot somebody in a store for stealing, you were immediately going to jail. That would have been like, how dare you? Mm-hmm. But now this is happening, and not just here, in other parts of the country as well. And it's almost like we're watching folks say, well, sometimes you just got to have, you got to allow for the vigilanteism. The narrative that's often pushed is that if only people in San Francisco could carry guns, and if only people in San Francisco could really cap back at the guys who broke their window or are sleeping in the alleyways, you know, doing drugs, then things would be better. And I'm wondering if you feel that there's a pandering to that crowd, because within a day's time, you know, the district attorney was like, yeah, we're going to let him go, because his life was basically threatened. This was a thing of self-defense. So I'm asking, you know, how does somebody who is unarmed become a severe threat that they have to be shot? You know, for that, I know if I have words with somebody and I shoot them, even if somebody pushes me and I shoot them there in the arm, I'm going to jail. You know, at the very least. So what's going on in the city that all of a sudden has changed?
To me, that it doesn't, whatever happened or occurred that day, that the person didn't have the right to be the judge, jury, and executioner all on that same moment. Like that was unbelievable. Benko's life was sacred. It was important. And we could never replace a life. We could replace monetary things or, you know, merchandise or whatever it is, but we can't replace a life, you know? And so, you know, that person has to live with that decision for the rest of their life. But well, one of the things that we were kind of like discussing about was, you know, and these could be Band-Aid solutions too, but this is like 48 hours of de-escalation training. Like folks have to understand, and also to disarm, you know, any private security or, you know, I was just saying that I was urging, you know.
But I want to cut you off. I want to come back to this, though.
Okay, listen.
They said that crime was going to disappear with the recall. That's what they said. San Francisco has 2,000 people that work within its police department.
Mm-hmm.
That's more than most cities its size.
Mm-hmm.
How is, in theory, I'm asking this, if you got all this law and order stuff going on, how's this happening in downtown where it's a tourist attraction in the first place? What is going on? It's all, you know what I'm saying? I'm confused because I heard the promises and now we're watching somebody who got shot. And from what I understand, it's not like they walked out with a bag full of stuff. If they even did that, it's not like they walked in there and said, stick them up, everybody, you know, give me the money. Yeah. I mean, we're talking like, you know, you're talking about, as you said, something that could easily be replaced. So one, that's one thing. But if you were supposed to be laying out all this new sheriff in town type of rhetoric, shouldn't there have been enough of a presence that this wouldn't have even happened in the first place? So what's going on? That's, you know.
And I haven't experienced any kind of listening sessions or somebody that's out in the community really trying to deeply understand like what's happening. Like I've only seen closed meetings and closed doors, and you know, I can't get a meeting with the person, you know. So I mean, I'm just wondering how she can accomplish what she's trying to accomplish without, you know, being able to include people that live in...
that are rooted in San Francisco, yeah, like yourself and others.
Yes.
What would you ask people to do moving forward with respect to Banco in this situation? I know you said you want to see the tapes that would justify this, or would lead to people understanding the justification that the DA said that led to Banco being shot. I don't know how that can be justified, but, you know, maybe there'll be something in the tapes that you go, oh, I understand, but, you know, that hasn't been communicated as of yet, and you all are right there. So are there any other things that you're asking for?
We're demanding safe housing and resources for young people that are navigating different forms of poverty or violence or any of those things to meet their basic immediate needs. On a human level, I'm asking folks that to really kind of go old school. We need to be old school about, like, really, it takes a village. It takes a village. Like I said, young people only make 11% of the population up. Just get more curious and, like, expanding yourself a little bit. You know, if I could tell you just one story, I remember I was driving in Oakland, and I remember I had went into a store, and a young person had the storekeeper, he had the young person sweeping the floors, and he had him wiping the windows, right? And afterwards, you know, I'm doing my shopping and I'm coming out, and he hands the toy to the young man, and he says, "Don't steal out this store no more." He said, "You," and I was like, "Wow, I don't know what I don't know for sure what happened that day. I don't know what happened inside of that Walgreens that day." And the tapes will allow people to understand. But I'm like, we have to have community approaches to things. We have to, like, even there's things that come up with, like, music and open spaces, and even churches have been targeted for playing music and things like that of these folks that aren't don't understand culturally, you know, what's makes San Francisco beautiful.
Yeah,
it has made it what it has historically been. So I'm on the more, you know, I'm a Mexica dancer. I'm an indigenous dancer. So I'm always going to try and do the more humane, you know, approaches to things. And hopefully we can reach folks in that way. And I also know that there's other branches of how, you know, speak up for public comments and to get civic engagement and things like that. And then if you're a decision maker, if you're somebody that does decision making, making sure that you include and think about marginalized folks that have been experiencing, you know, the most impact of over policing, mass incarceration, have historically had been oppressed.
Julia Arroyo, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon.
Okay,
we will keep, you know, the thoughts to pursue justice for the murder of Banco Brown. And, you know, we appreciate the work that you all do at the Young Women's Freedom Center. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
How can people get a hold of y'all?
So youngwomenfree.org. So just check us out at youngwomenfree.org.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Adamawi.
Inslasia.
The Anastalin.
Yo, Ibako City and Talwa. Addis Ababa. Yo!
I was born in a system that doesn't give a fuck about you nor me nor the life. I fuck it, keep my guns loud, you never know, just think tight, things get free. That's just the way I live, yeah. That's me, yeah, as is.
I'm a young boss, mob nigga till I cross. Over to that next side, man, call it what you want. Heaven or hell, mind you can still a rebel. And find new ways that we can take it to the next level.
Tell God stop fearing itself. Slow down and pay attention to the kids in the ghetto. Down here, it's big business. If you ain't got wealth, you ain't got shit. All y'all about to bear witness to the infinite, infamous team. You can't put a time frame on us. We infinitely make a dynasty look like a canceled show. Make your whole life story look like a real hoax. Niggas got their mind on our money, they watching us grow. But they can't eat off our trees, poison, yo. Get your hand out of my pockets, you already know. I'm counting money every time you try to reach me on the phone.
I was born in a system that doesn't give a fuck about you, nor me, nor the lie. Fuck it, keep my guns loud. You never know, just in case things get free. That's just the way I live. Yeah, that's me, yeah, as is.
My destiny's a billion bucks. Such and such was looking for you. Cause that's what you get when you think that I'm tricking. You got it twisted, baby girl, I'm about my business. Please don't get me mixed in with them lames you be running them games on. Listen, that's some real talk before you spread the news. Half serious, analyze rap lyric. I break down your spirit like a dog taught not to go nowhere near it. Palms itch like an athlete's foot. We getting money, eyes twitching. You coward talking about me all funny now. You done talked me up, so there I is in the back. Cool range, over seven of bands. With the haze flowing heavily, you know what it is. We going down, police pull us, they know what it is. Mad guns with us, but you know them things. Well, here to be a bust of the century, they raid the crib.
I was born in a system that doesn't give a fuck about you, nor me, nor the lie. Fuck it, keep my guns loud. You never know, just in case things get free. That's just the way I live, yeah. That's me, yeah, I say.
Hey, yo, that's my word. And look, we don't play around here. Fuck what you heard. Clickin' when it's on me right there. No reason to be scared. My gun right here. And assume my goons are somewhere near. I'm hoodie, I admit it, but dig it. I'm real. And my diamonds be blinding them walls when they stare. So I scoop one and put in a coop, then I pair.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio, KBOO 90.7.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Follow the money, they say. The truth is found where and how the capital goes. Our modern world has run based on a collective paradigm, unlimited growth driven by consumption, measured by gross national and international product, and enabled by fossil fuels. Regardless of the form of government, the quality and inequality of life, the system relies on the strategic placement and withdrawal of capital in a universe of cheap energy, international labor, global trade, inequitable outcomes, predictable or foreseen, be damned. And damned, some say, we may be. Capitalism, socialism, autocracy, democracy, all are founded on a definition of value, measured in BTUs or petrodollars, diamonds or gold, negotiable instruments or cryptocurrencies, a complicated system of value definition and monetary exchange that drives the forces of development, technology, financial policy, governance, and community. It is a system of overt power and covert consequence, studied by bankers and economists, investors and legislators who thrive or not in the dangerous financial swim. It is a dynamic system, interconnected, unpredictable, susceptible to waves of despair and wonder. It is rich and poor. It gives and takes. It is very much like the ocean, and as such, it is also corruptible and vulnerable to compromise, abuse, poison, and corruption. There is ample evidence to declare that the old paradigm is dead, but what is to come? What must come if we, in our wisdom, are to save ourselves from ourselves? The sea connects all things. The ocean freshwater atmospheric cycle is at the core of every problem and every solution, be it freshwater, food, energy, health, community, equity, justice, or peace. The ocean ecosystem is the world's only natural asset from which everything is derived and from which everything can be sustained. But only if we transform our values, structures, and behaviors around a new paradigm, managed growth, driven by sustainability, measured by calculation of ecosystem service and enabled by water, the essential resource without which we cannot survive. We have exhausted so much of the planet's value and risk exhausting society and ourselves unless in an expression of global determination we divest from the disproven conventions and invest in a new system of ocean finance. Over the next few editions on Rescue as a Plan for the Future, we will offer examples of change in how we calculate value and apply capital that will transform the world we live in. We will address four strategic changes, none of which is easy, each of which has its logic that affirms the new paradigm. 1. The definition of ecosystem services. 2. The necessary shifts in accounting standards and practices to document the true cost of goods and services. 3. The application of new value assessment to balance sheets, risk analyses, planning studies, permit applications, financing proposals, regulatory systems, and the assignment of incentives and subsidies. And 4. The public acceptance of the systemic change as an indicator of political and social viability by which accountability can be measured in individual and community growth, sustainability reward, targeted technology, return on investment, and relief of some of the most destructive causes of present-day inequity, injustice, and quality of life. These exemplary behaviors, as radical or difficult as they may seem, are the axis around which we can create a new system for the valuation and preservation of natural assets compatible with sustainable supply, restorative of our distressed circumstance, and inducive to societal repair and advancement. If we can adopt and adapt to these changes, we can move with confidence as a unified society no longer damned, but hell-bent on rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass